This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is the former owner of the American Basketball Association's Spirits of St. Louis, Dan Silna, who with his late brother Ozzie were part of what many consider to be the greatest sports deal in history. Since the NBA didn't want their team to be part of the 1976 merger, the Silna brothers proposed the four merging teams, the Nets, Spurs, Pacers, and Nuggets, would pay them 1/7 of their national TV money. Forever. The deal made the Silna brothers, who already became a huge success in the textile industry, mega millionaires when the NBA TV contracts eventually exploded with the likes of Magic Johnson and Larry Bird joining the league. Dan Silna joins us in the studio to talk about that deal, his career, and his passions, one of which is related to an upcoming panel discussion hosted by Dan's longtime friend Bob Costas at the Columbia Law School on November 19th. Dan, thanks for coming in and being a guest on Sports Jam.
Doug, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Lessons from the Munich Olympics, and you have a very special moderator, Bob Costas. You and Bob go way back, but let's first of all, why did you want to have this event?
Bob was the impetus for having this event. In 1992, Bob made a comment about the Munich massacre that had no effect on the IOC. And then again in 2012, he was the only person that made reference to what had occurred 40 years prior. And after Bob's commentary on this subject, as fate would have it, my youngest daughter, Amy, happened to run into someone who was a survivor of that massacre. And I started to think about Bob's comments, and I felt that it would be a wonderful thing if we could get a group of panelists together to discuss what occurred in 72, what we have learned from 72, and regrettably, what we haven't learned since 1972.
It was ABC's legendary Olympic host Jim McKay who broke the news in Munich about the athletes and coaches.
I've just gotten the final word. You know, when I was a kid, my father used to say, our greatest hopes and our worst fears are seldom realized. Our worst fears have been realized tonight. They've now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. Nine were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
And Bob and I had discussed this earlier this month. There are so many people who don't remember because a whole generation has come through, Dan, that can't even recall what happened in the 72 Munich games. And because there haven't been enough remembrances of it, they have no idea.
Absolutely. My daughter, who is now 45, was just born when this all occurred. So her generation knows very, very little, if anything. And the fact that it was an Israeli delegation and the politics surrounding it, I guess, have made it difficult for the IOC to do anything. I can only imagine what it would have been, let's say, had it been a Spanish group of athletes who had been killed by Basque separatists. I think it would have been commemorated every time there was an Olympics.
What do you remember from that time period? We all remember Jim McKay's They're All Gone, but what do you specifically remember about that incident?
Well, I remember the broadcast. I remember seeing pictures of the masked terrorists. I remember hearing McKay say they're all gone. I remember them taking off in the helicopters. But it was not personal to me. And what we have in this group of panelists are one person who survived it, and his story is extremely interesting. We have the author who helped him write the book about his experience. We have the son of one of the people who regrettably was massacred. We have a number of people who have tried over the last decade or more to get the IOC to recognize that event and honor these Olympic athletes. Forget what their ethnicity or what their country was. These were Olympic athletes. And the Olympics are supposed to be a place for peace and harmony and where everyone is the same. And regrettably, it hasn't been dealt with that way.
Source of frustration, I would imagine.
Very much so. Less for me, obviously, than those who are personally and directly involved. The first person who was killed in that was the wrestling coach. His son, who was then a baby, is one of the panelists. And I'm sure he can tell you what it's like for him growing up and for growing up without a father and for what it was like for his mother, which was extremely difficult.
Danny Elon, the fencer.
Yes.
I would imagine that as time has gone on, the scars and the pain, they don't go away in this incident because there hasn't been enough healing involved.
Oh, I'm pretty sure. You know, we talk about our soldiers and PTSD. I have found that one of the most interesting things is when a soldier loses a buddy, he feels guilty that why did my friend get killed and I'm still here? And I've got to believe that Dan Elon has the same problems and has questioned that on a regular basis.
The Gerard Berman Day School. It's the Torch Talk series, and this one's coming up on November 19th. So this is a fundraiser for the school that your grandson attends.
Not only my grandson, I have a grandson and a granddaughter there. I have another grandson who graduated from that school 4 years ago. He's now in college. And the school is a gem of a little institution. Regrettably, it does not get the kind of publicity that it deserves. They take students and treat them on a one-to-one basis. It's a very small school. I think we have a little over 100 kids from pre-K through 8. And if more people knew about the school, I think their attendance would be better. And this fundraiser is going to go to help support a lot of the programs that they run on a continual basis.
Like a media center as well, right?
A media center, which is in the process now of being planned. A new science lab, which is a necessity going forward. We have excellent teachers, but we're always looking to upgrade the quality of the teaching staff. And all of these things, regrettably, cost money.
And I would imagine because this event's being held for the school, they're being educated about what happened in the Munich Games as well, if they hadn't to this point.
I'm sure they are, and I'm sure they didn't know. And in many cases, their parents didn't know, because that's that 40-year span where, you know, if you talk about a child who's in the, let's assume the fourth grade is 9 years old, and his parents married when they're mid-20s or late-20s, they're not familiar with what occurred. And as a student of history, I know the following. If we forget about history, we're doomed to repeat it. That's the famous comment, and I believe that. So we've got to let more people know what happened and keep it alive.
It's that history. I'm also a lover of history, and to go back and to reopen what took place there. I even asked Bob when we were talking about, could he see something like this happen again? And he goes, well, why do we have so much security? If something like this could be repeated. History seems to repeat itself when one group of people doesn't get along with another.
Well, it's true. And it doesn't have to be the same groups of people involved. Regrettably, we humans have a penchant for hating those who are different than us. And if we could learn to not have that hatred, boy, would this be a better world.
And one thing about the Olympics that's sad that this took place so many years ago is, as you mentioned, it's supposed to be a different playing ground. The Olympics is supposed to bring athletes together, and in many times it has. Lifelong relationships between various athletes of different countries have developed and stayed through the course of time, but just this incident certainly was the dark moment.
Well, you got to remember what the world was like at that time. There were two Germanys. The Cold War was in really a hot war, if you want to call it that. I mean, do you remember the other thing that happened at the 72 Olympics? That the U.S. basketball team lost the championship that year.
In one of the most unbelievable ways.
Well, if you get three or four chances to win, back to back to back to back.
The late Frank Gifford had the call for ABC in this version from ESPN Classic.
Well, confusion reigns, but the United States still, they have that one-point lead, 50-49, as a result of two pressure-packed foul shots by Doug Collins of Illinois State. Now the clock shows 3 seconds. There is time for the Russians to go to their big man, Alexander Belov. They're going to try. Alexander Belov between two American defenders. Back there with him, Jim Forbes and McMillan. And the Russian team has robbed Alexander Belov. And this time it is over. First, it was indicated the U.S. had won 49-48.
As a young kid, I was upset and felt betrayed by the officials and how it was all worked out. You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is philanthropist Dan Silna, who was one of those responsible for putting together a special panel discussion on November 19th at Columbia University Law School, entitled Lessons from the Munich Olympics. The panel will discuss the murder of 11 Israeli hostages at the 1972 Olympic Games in Munich. It will be moderated by Bob Costas, with the proceeds going to creating a media center at the Gerard Berman Day School in North Jersey. You could have met Dan Silna in St. Louis in the 1970s when he and his brother Ozzie were the owners of the Spirits of St. Louis ADA franchise. Let's find out more on Sports Jam from Dan Silna. Take us back to when the ABA was merging with the NBA. What were you presented with, and why did you and your brother come up with this amazing idea to get some ad revenue from the teams that were going to merge in the NBA to make you millionaires?
In 1976, there were 7 teams left in the ABA. There were 18 teams at that time in the NBA. We felt that a merger of the two leagues would be a great thing. And we felt that of the 7 teams, 6 would logically go in. It would be an even number. You would have 4 6-team divisions, interleague, you know, interdivisional play and what have you. But the there were 2 impetuses for the merger. Number one is the NBA was getting outbid for a lot of really top-notch stars. They'd lost David Thompson to Denver. They lost Marvin Barnes to us. And there was continuing war, and you know, none of the owners wanted to continue shelling out the kind of money that at that time was big dollars. And the other impetus was that I believe CBS was the network who televised the NBA games. And their comment was, if you expand by at least 4 teams, they would pay them an additional $2 million in TV revenue. Well, if you only have to expand by at least 4, why would you do more than 4? And at the same time, then be able to take the talent that existed on the other 3 teams and divide it between your league. And that's what actually occurred. We were told 4 teams were going to go in. The Nets had Julius Erving. That was a no-brainer. Indiana was the most stable franchise. That was also a no-brainer. San Antonio had George Gervin. And Denver had David Thompson. And those 4 teams were the 4 teams that were then tried to make the deal to merge in. And we were given the option of taking cash, and we turned it down.
The foresight to do that is amazing. Did you have any idea at that point how big the NBA would become?
No. Let's understand. The reason we did it is that we felt all along that the major difference between the two leagues wasn't talent. The major difference was that the NBA was on TV and the ABA was not. We felt that television had a tremendous future with the game, even though, if you recall, Doug, the NBA playoffs were taped and played after the 11 o'clock news here in New York. But we knew there was a tremendous upside. And at a prior meeting of the league owners, Board of Governors meeting, when we thought six teams were going in, my brother had suggested that, listen, we're all partners in this. The seventh team, the one that doesn't get in, should be treated equally to the other six. And the way he felt it, that we could do it was that that remaining team would get 1/7 of the six teams' revenues. So that way everyone would get what ultimately would be 6/7 of a share. And, you know, at that meeting, it was generally accepted as that's what was going to happen.
You talk about how the talent certainly was in both leagues. The names you have already mentioned, and on your team, you had Moses Malone, you had Marvin Barnes, you had NBA quality players playing for your team. When it came to the spirits of St. Louis, as Bob described it, one of the craziest basketball teams ever, you're smiling. Tell me why you're smiling when I bring up the spirits of St. Louis, as you and your brother owned this squad during a really amazing time with some amazing players.
We had the team for 2 years. We came into the league in 1974. We bought the Carolina Cougars. And as a kid, I was a St. Louis Hawk fan. My favorite basketball player in the NBA was Bob Pettit. And the Hawks had moved out of St. Louis and moved to Atlanta. And St. Louis was also the sixth largest marketplace, TV marketplace, in the United States at that time. And it was the only one that did not have a professional basketball team. So we moved the team to St. Louis. Going in, one of our key demands of the league was that I didn't know who held the draft rights to Marvin Barnes, but we would only buy the team if we got those draft rights, and the league agreed. And we signed Marvin to a 7-year deal. And Marvin was multi-talented. Regrettably, he did not have the kind of work ethic that you would hope in a player. But, well, you know that story, don't you, about the fact that he missed the plane one day and he had to hire a private plane to fly to Virginia, and the coach was so mad at him that he wouldn't play him for the first quarter. And then he put Marvin in, and for the rest of the game, all Marvin managed to do is pull down 40 rebounds and score 30-plus points. Multi-talented. You know, Julius Erving has been, everybody says Julius was far and away the best player in the league. There were nights that Marvin Barnes was better than Julius Erving.
Here is Marvin Barnes from the right sideline and hitting. As he picks up where he left off, he cranked up 40 shots on Sunday night and hit exactly half of them, making 20 field goals and 9 of 10 from the free throw line for a total of 49, the Spirits' season high.
When I asked Bob Costas earlier this month about his favorite memory of the Spirits of St. Louis, this is what he said.
The guy who kind of was the face of the franchise, for better and sometimes for worse, Marvin Barnes, who was one of the most talented players ever, if he had fulfilled his potential, I have no doubt that in 1997, on the 50th anniversary of the NBA, when they named the 50 greatest players to that point in the league's history, if he had fulfilled his potential, he certainly would have been on that stage as one of the 50. He was the second player taken in the draft the year he came out after Bill Walton in both the NBA and the ABA, and he was the rookie of the year in the ABA that first year. There were many nights where he was on the floor with Moses Malone and with Dr. J, and he was the best player on the floor. He was also quite self-destructive, and by the time he was 26, 27, he had burned himself out, combination of drugs and various other missteps that he had. But he had a certain irresistibly likable quality about him. And there's a zillion stories, but the one people most like to hear is when the Spirits played at Kentucky against the old Kentucky Colonels, who had Artis Gilmore and Dan Issel, coached by Hubie Brown, won the ABA title the second to last year of the league's existence, a very good team. And teams didn't travel by charter then. And so after yet another loss at Freedom Hall in Louisville, we gathered at the airport, and the traveling secretary, who doubled as the trainer, shoestring operation, handed out the itinerary, and it said, TWA flight 305, Depart Louisville 8 a.m. Arrive St. Louis 7:56. Because Louisville's in the Eastern time zone, even though it's only about a 4 to 5 hour drive from St. Louis. So arrive St. Louis 7:56, and Marvin Barnes walked over to me, brandishing this piece of paper, draped an arm over my shoulder, and from more than a foot above me, looked down and said, "Bro, I don't know about you, but as for me, I am not getting on any time machine."
It's still good to hear.
Yeah, so I said to him, "Listen, Marvin, let me examine your theory here. Is your theory that if we continue to fly indefinitely in a westerly direction, we might meet Lincoln?" And the thing was, people thought at first that this indicated that Marvin was clueless, but Marvin was really smart, self-destructive, but smart. And he knew he was saying something really funny, and he was doing it on purpose, and he was trying to do it to someone he thought would get it, and I did.
Bob Costas, your play-by-play announcer, Dan, for the Spirits of St. Louis. And what a collection of characters, what a collection of talent on that roster. Of course, it all came to an end.
You know, interestingly, you know, the next year, 1977, after the merger, do you recall who won the championship?
No.
Portland. They had a young center by the name of Walton.
That would be Bill Walton.
Right. But two of the starting five players on that Portland Trailblazers team that won the championship in 77 came out of the ABA. One was Maurice Lucas, who we had the pleasure of signing and who I had the pleasure of watching for a year plus. And the other was Dave Twardzik, a very scrappy little guard who played for the Virginia Squires. But without the two of them, do they win the title? Probably not.
The ABA, from the ball itself, the look of the ball, it attracted me to basketball first. I mean, I had an ABA ball that I would shoot in the backyard. No cement, just ground. And take that NBA ball and be George Gervin, be Dr. J. There was amazing players with highlight ability. If the ABA was on television, it would have never folded, right?
I probably think that Sense would have caused a merger, but the merger would have been under different conditions. And I want you to understand something. We took the deal that we took because really there was no other option. The option we wanted was we wanted to be merged into the NBA and have a professional basketball team that would compete for the title. And that's what it was all about from the very beginning.
You and your brother Ozzie were basketball fans from an early age. You remember watching him. Tell us about those days where you'd go upstairs from the synagogue and watch him play basketball.
We grew up in North Bergen, New Jersey. And my brother... prior to my birth, my parents lived in West New York, and my brother played for a West New York synagogue basketball team. The synagogue's still there, by the way. And there was an 11-and-a-half-year difference between us. So when I was 5, he was 16, 17 years old. I remember being the mascot for that team and coming out dribbling a basketball at the age of 5, and, of course, I couldn't reach the basket. So when I got to the basket, like in a layup line, I would throw the ball over my head to whoever was behind me, and he would make the layup. And then he would go through the layup line, and I'd go on the sidelines. I've loved basketball since I'm that old. And I still love basketball.
What is it about this game that you wanted to be an owner? You became an owner for an ABA franchise. You wanted to be an owner of an NBA team as well. What was it about this game that really stirred inside Dan Silna?
If you have the talent, anybody of any size can play this game, enjoy the game, and feel good about what they do. I'm at my highest height-wise. I was 5'10.5" tall. I'm a realist. At 5'10.5", and not being extremely quick, I could never play the game at the level that these guys play. And I always felt that if you can't play it, the next best thing is to own it, to run it, and to create a championship theme. I mean, I'm looking in awe about this year's World Series, all right? Greatest series in a long, long time. But I'm in awe of the guy who created the Chicago Cubs. Theo Epstein has now done this twice. He's done it with the Red Sox and done it with the Cubs. And that's what I wanted to hopefully be able to do with a basketball team.
Do you feel if you had more opportunity that there would have, I mean, you guys did make the playoffs.
We made the playoffs the first year. The second year, we didn't. And I learned something the second year. And this may be anathema to every general manager across the board. Talent is amazing. Talent can't be replaced. But talent in itself doesn't win basketball games. We didn't become a good basketball team in 1974-75 until we got someone who understood the game of basketball and had a great deal of heart and made the people perform. And that was a fellow by the name of Don Adams. If you remember him, he played for the Detroit Pistons. And when he got cut by the Pistons, we picked him up. And he made a huge difference. He was a pro. He understood what it took to win. And he kept a lot of these young guns in line. And talent is not enough to win. You need heart. I was a baseball fan as a kid. Brooklyn Dodger fan. When the Dodgers moved to L.A., I stayed a Los Angeles Dodger fan. I remember they had a terrible year the first year in L.A. And in 1958-59, in the offseason, they made a trade. They traded a fellow by the name of Gino Cimoli, who was a five-tool player, to the St. Louis Cardinals for Wally Moon. The difference between the two was Gino Cimoli had 100% talent and maybe gave you 80% of it, and Wally Moon had 85% talent and gave you 110. That's what you need to win. I think with more time, yeah, I think we could have put together something that would have made the city of St. Louis proud if we were still there, or wherever we were playing, we would have competed for the title.
If you did become an NBA owner, now probably one of the most recognizable faces of NBA ownership right now would be Mark Cuban, because of his connections with all kinds of media outlets and whatnot. How would you be? How would you be today? How would you compare yourself to some of these owners if you were still owning an NBA franchise? It's a whole different story now.
Yeah, there's a lot more public relations involved today. My brother was the one who was involved with the Board of Governors. He was more the face of the franchise. My tasks, if you wish to call them that, because it wasn't a task, it was really a love, was to be on the creative side. My brother, we had a reunion prior to my brother's passing. It was a 40-year reunion. It was 2014. And my brother sat there and said, listen, all of this is due to my brother Danny. He wanted a team. He convinced me about it. And he took more part in getting the team going and running than my brother Ozzy had. And I was extremely complimented by that, and I still am.
How has Dan Sona changed without Ozzy around?
My brother and I had been business partners for 47 years. There wasn't a week that went by that I didn't speak to him at least two or three times. I had the security of knowing that he was there and that if there was an issue or a problem, I had a real bright guy to bounce things off of. And I miss him terribly.
The garment industry, polyester, all associated with the Silnas. Take us back to those days and how basically you were able to mass a fortune and then lead yourself into ownership of a professional basketball team.
My parents came to this country in 1939. My father and mother went to work for a cousin in the embroidery manufacturing business. My father was a watcher on an embroidery machine. My father worked nights, my mother worked days, which explains the huge difference in age between my brother and me. My brother was seven when he came here. My father worked hard. My brother, at one point, was given the responsibility to run the business over a summer while my parents went to Israel. And during that summer, a large government bid came out. And my brother looked at it, and Ozzie was a great businessman. He concluded that anybody who took that bid would need a humongous amount of cloth, the background cloth, to stitch on. So what he did is he basically bought up all the cloth in the market. And when the bid came out, he was not necessarily the lowest bidder, but no one else could perform. And he got a huge chunk of the bid in negotiation with the government. That was the start.
And what was your involvement in all this once you got it? You got it, you know, as you mentioned, you were 11 years younger. How did you get involved in all this?
When my brother did that, I was in grammar school.
So it was a while before you could become really involved in the family business then.
Correct. Ozzie and my father entered in a business venture with a friend of theirs. They bought some double knit machines and they started a double knit factory in West New York, which they sold to a large dress company. And my brother was running their factory for them, not the one in West New York, because they had their own factory in Brooklyn. They merged the two, and they moved to Pagoda, New Jersey. My brother was running it, and the company was supposed to go public. And I remember talking to my brother at his home in Teaneck, and he would always complain that in order to keep his factory running 100%, he had to overbook by 10, 15%. And then if the problems that he normally would anticipate didn't occur, he'd have to run around looking for people to do contract knitting for him. So I convinced my father to buy some knitting machines. We got approval from his boss to work for him, and we worked for him and others. And when the deal to take the company public didn't happen the way my brother liked it, my brother came to us and said, okay, we're going direct. And that was April of 1969.
Mm. We're speaking with Dan Silna here on Sports Jam. Let's take it back to the spirits of St. Louis again, when you had the opportunity to purchase this team and become a part of the ABA. Do you remember the first game that you were in charge and how it went? And you just sat back and said, it's happening. I own a professional basketball team.
Do I remember the first game?
Yeah, do you
vividly.
Tell me about it.
We had an 8-point lead with a minute and 48 seconds to play, and we had the ball. And our young power forward at the time, a fellow named Auguste Girard, got the ball in a corner, and he took a shot from a corner, and he missed. And we were playing the Memphis Sounds. They came down and scored. And then they started to full-court press. And we had trouble getting the ball in, and they scored again, and they scored again. And we ended up losing the game. I was thrilled to be an owner. I was upset about having lost the game that we should have been able to put away. And I realized that our guards were substandard. And when we had an opportunity a couple of weeks later, when the late Harry Weltman called me and he said, listen, Memphis is willing to trade their point guard, Freddie Lewis, to us for Tom Owens, I said, jump at it. And Freddie made a huge difference to that team. In fact, if Freddie hadn't twisted his ankle in the playoffs against Kentucky, we could have beaten Kentucky that year.
The Kentucky Colonels.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, some owners just kind of have a hands-off approach. It sounds like you really had a hands-on approach to the team. You watched the games, you cared about the players, and had some decisions to make when it came to personnel. Is that how you'd like to run the team at that time?
Yes. Harry Weltman, who was our general manager and who moved with his wife to St. Louis, before he generally made any decisions, he would call me and run them past me and make sure that I was on board. I don't need publicity. I believe that the main thing that you have to do if you're between the lines on a basketball court or a baseball diamond or a football field is give 100% and win. And that's been my impetus all my life.
Dan, you mentioned how you and your brother, you talked about your brother being this incredible businessman. And indeed, when this deal was made, That ABA franchise was your baby. You can hear how you talk about it with the passion that you talk about the spirits of St. Louis. So we understand why you would want to make the best deal, this best deal possible. Perpetuity is the key word in that deal. Forever is what basically perpetuity means. But the NBA finally came to a conclusion with you in 2014. Can you tell us just briefly what that means as far as the deal that you were able to make millions of dollars from? It eventually has come to somewhat of an end.
Well, first, let's deal with a misconception. The deal never said in perpetuity. The deal said, so long as the National Basketball Association should remain in existence.
All right, so that word never was in there then.
Well, I went to law school, and one of the things I learned in law school was that there's a law against perpetuities. That's why the word perpetuity never appeared. Not because of me, but because of our partner, Donald Shupak, who was an excellent attorney. But it was hooked into the existence of the NBA. At a certain point, we felt we were being shortchanged on certain revenues, and we brought suit in New York, federal court. And the judge suggested very strongly to the parties that they negotiate, otherwise she was going to have to make a decision, a Solomonic decision. And I think negotiation is always the better way than pride. Pride goeth before a great fall. So we negotiated a deal that we thought was fair to us and fair to the owners of the four teams.
One of the investments that you made did not work out. You invested with Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, we had money invested with Bernie Madoff. We treated Bernie Madoff's account more like a bank. If we had some spare cash, we put it in, and if we needed cash, we pulled it out. No one knew Bernie was a crook. He'd gotten SEC passed by the FCC, I think, three or four times. Hindsight's 20/20. Obviously, if I knew then what I knew now, we never would have made any of those investments.
Time has gone on now, and this event that's coming up on November 19th, Lessons from the Munich Olympics. What do you think Ozzy would want to hear about this event if he was here?
I think Ozzy would be thrilled that Bob was moderating. You know, Bob got hired. I don't know if you heard that story from Bob.
22 years of age, you hired him as the play-by-play announcer for the Spirits of St. Louis. But I want to find out from you is why you took the chance on this young man.
Bob's roommate was working for the Spirits, ex-roommate in college, was working for the Spirits. And he called Bob and said, hey, Bob, I think, we're looking for an announcer. Can you get us something? And they got a tape in. And Bob's tape played. My brother heard it. My brother said, wow, that guy's good. Let's hire him. And the rest is history. You know, you talk about how successful everybody from the Spirits was or wasn't. Without a doubt, Bob Costas is the most successful member of the Spirits. 27 Emmy Awards. He's one of the brightest guys and hardest working guys in the industry.
How did he know that from just listening to a tape? Because sometimes, he obviously was still young in the business, had somewhat of a tie with the organization, but to know that you couldn't really know that he was going to become this legendary broadcaster. But what was it about that tape? Did you hear something specific, you or your brother, that said, other than, boy, he's good, that he fit the Spirits of St. Louis?
When my brother heard Bob's tape, Bob, I'm not sure even Bob was doing a baseball game, I think, rather than a basketball game. But there was something about Bob's demeanor and Bob's attitude and his excitement about doing what he was doing that caught my brother's ear. And, we didn't know if he would fit in. You know, and when the Spirits left, you got to remember the NBC network, which was KMLX at that time, thought so highly of Bob, they kept him on. So it wasn't just what we thought. Bob's a darn good announcer, and Bob is very, very good at, you remember his show, the late night show where he would do interviews? You don't realize how knowledgeable Bob is across the board. And on top of that, he's a good guy.
And obviously, when you asked for him to be the moderator, he told us that, you know, that was very important to him. Those who want to get involved and to attend this event at the Columbia Law School, what do they need to do, Dan?
Well, they can go online and buy tickets. There is a cocktail party prior to it. Depending upon the amount you wish to spend, you can come to the cocktail party as well. I think it'll be a wonderful evening. I know that the reason it's at Columbia Law School is that one of the people that was massacred, the only American that was massacred, was David Berger. And he was a graduate of Columbia Law. And for many years, the ex-dean wanted to find a way to honor him. And when we approached Columbia Law School about it, they were more than happy to join in advertising and supporting this event. So go online, buy your tickets. I think it'll be a great evening. It'll certainly be an educational evening.
If you join Bob Costas on a broadcast for the next Olympics and he turned the mic over to you and said, I know you feel strongly about remembering what happened in 1972 in Munich, what would you say to the nation?
I would say that we should never forget about man's inhumanity to man, and that we all think that we're safe, and there are many times we're not, but we have to find a way to care about and love each other and not find reasons to hate.
Dan, you have the power to do a lot of things. What are you most passionate about? What's your biggest cause right now that you're backing?
I have always been involved in Jewish causes. I'm a past president of my synagogue. I'm past president of my local Y. I'm past president of the Federation of Bergen County. And they're all worthwhile. I'm now a co-president of the academies at Gerard Berman Day School. And this is where my bent has been. I'm now a grandfather, and I never knew my grandparents. As I said to you, my parents came here just before the start of World War II, and my grandparents were lost in the Holocaust. I have always been involved in Jewish causes for the most part. We've also been involved in our local hospital to some extent. My wife is a cancer survivor, so we're involved in cancer research. Right now it's Gerard Berman. I don't know what's next.
Your thoughts as you went through the Holocaust Museum in D.C. for the first time?
Heartache. I'm not one who cries easily. I didn't cry then. But again, man's inhumanity to man is something that is unbelievable. I felt the same way when I went through Auschwitz. How people could do this to other people is beyond me.
One last question here on Sports Jam for you, Dan. If you could own any NBA franchise right now, what would it be and why?
Well, that's a toughie, Doug. We tried in 1979 to buy the Nets. We were not successful. I'd want it to be something local so that I could touch it, feel it, be in it more than do it over a telephone long distance. I think that you look at what they've done out in Golden State, and I'm sure the Durant deal will work out. I think they just have to figure out where all the parts really fit. But I look at what the San Antonio franchise has done over a extended period of time and the success that they've enjoyed. It's a great franchise.
Would you have kept the Nets in New Jersey?
I would have tried to.
Sad when they left here. I mean, they really enjoyed walking down the street and watching professional basketball at Prudential Center.
Oh, I enjoyed going to the Meadowlands. It's a tough sell. I think the move to Brooklyn as a financial situation was a good one. I think the steps they took once they were going to Brooklyn didn't make a lot of sense. They traded their future for perhaps a one shot at a championship, which I certainly would have not have done. When you move a team, you have a 2 or 3 year grace period to make it work. Instantaneous gratification didn't work here. And they've sold a future. They've sold a 3 to 5 year period where they're really not going to be able to compete for a title.
You might not be a crier, but you're an emotional man, I can tell, and you're someone who is passionate about everything you do. And we appreciate you being on Sports Jam.
Doug, thank you for having me. I don't do interviews very often. I appreciate you taking the time today.
A reminder, Lessons from the Munich Olympics is coming up this Saturday, November 19th, with Bob Costas as the moderator. It will take place at Columbia University Law School. Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.